Is this Laura?
Yes, hello.
Hi, Laura. I just got your email and I apologize.
That's all right. No problem.
No, it's not. It's terrible. Unfortunately, I didn't put it into my calendar and I was in another meeting.
Oh, that's all right.
So for you, this is just my phone. As I understand it, the quality isn't as high as it would be, say, off of a tablet. I don't want to waste any more time of you, but if I was to jump in my vehicle and head back home, I could then jump on my iPad and we could do it in like 20 minutes.
Sure. I mean, the sound is fine here, but if that's easier for you, that's totally fine.
No, I can do it standing right here, right now.
Okay.
Let me just open up my notes then.
Yeah, no problem. Take all your time.
No, it's good. It's loading up right now. I do apologize. I don't like missing things.
No, it's totally all right.
Just loading up. Word here. Thanks very much for those questions. They were good, and they certainly gave me a chance to think about some of them, because certainly I'll be giving you my perspective on a lot of stuff, which isn't necessarily the perspective of the wider military.
Great. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. So thank you again for participating.
No, it's great. I believe I did an interview many years ago after one of my Bosnia tours, and it was just over the phone, but it was good. It's interesting to have an archive like that of, you know, experiences and whatnot going back as long as it does.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a new program, so we're just kind of in the beginning stages. So I appreciate it again.
I'm just going to turn off my office mate's radio here, or maybe I'll just smash it. There we go. Well, why don't we start? And I don't know why word's taking so long here, but it will load. I guarantee it.
All right. Do you have any questions before we start?
No, I think I'm good. And so this is for this is part of the work you're doing towards a master's degree?
I'm in my undergraduate degree, actually.
Oh, okay.
This is it's a undergraduate course, and then it will be for the military oral history program. And then it will all be donated to the special collections at the library.
Oh, very nice. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Well, we'll just begin then.
Absolutely.
This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Major Mike Sully, recorded on March 14th, 2017, at the University of Victoria, interviewed by Laura Milne. Major Sully, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Absolutely.
Great. All right. First, would you mind giving us a brief introduction about yourself and your military service?
Sure, absolutely. So I joined the Canadian Scottish Regiment, Princess Mary's, as a private soldier in 1996. I was fresh from air cadets, and I was in my first year of undergraduate studies at UVic. 20 years later, after a host of operational postings, more schooling, a civilian career, I'm still affiliated with the Canadian Scottish Regiment, although I'm currently serving at 39th Canadian Brigade Group Headquarters as the G7, which is the long-range strategic planner in Vancouver.
Great. Do you have any family that has serving or has served in the military?
Absolutely. My grandfather was in the Calgary Highlanders during World War II, and my great uncle also served on a corvette in the Royal Canadian Navy. And my brother joined the Canadian Scottish Regiment after me, and he currently serves as an operator in the Canadian Special Operations Regiment.
Thanks. Why did you first enlist with the military?
That's an interesting question, and it was for a variety of reasons, but the first, of course, was to go to Royal Military College, as all cadets want to do. It was at the exact same time as Royal Roads was in Victoria as a military college, but had just been shut down, and unfortunately, my marks weren't high enough to get in. So instead, I went to UVic, and I'm not sure if it's okay to use this term, but I was effectively shanghaied into the Canadian Scottish Regiment directly from the recruiting center. I had no idea about the military reserves. I just knew that they said, if you head down there, there's somebody that'd like to see you. And that happened to be the recruiting sergeant.
Great. So when you enlisted, what was your training with the militia like?
Good question. I'm just going to reload my notes here.
Yeah,
no problem.
But I have
something to go off of.
Yeah, take your time.
I'm not sure why it's so troublesome today. Perhaps... Perhaps it's corrupted a little bit. There we go. Come on. You can do it. This is wild. Let's try a third time. I can certainly answer the questions without the notes, but I did want to highlight a few bits of training here. Come on.
It's okay. I know we started a bit rushed, so it's no problem.
Now, this one is now an IT error, but I'm not sure why. My interview questions won't load. I wanted to make sure that I had a few somewhat intelligent things to say to you. Okay, we'll try one more time. And if it doesn't work, then we'll just shoot from the hip.
All right, sounds good.
Come on, little fella. Just going to the task manager here. Oh, strange. Well, we'll just wing it, and hopefully these eventually load up.
All right.
Okay, so the question was tell you a little bit about the training that I undertook?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, absolutely. So when I joined up, it was very much geared towards the university students. So to that end, I joined up, and then I saw myself going away for the first summer to Wainwright, Alberta, to the PPCLI Battle School, and that took place between, I think, late May all the way to the end of the August, and that was my basic training, and then all my training as a infantry soldier that took place at that time, and that allowed me then to go back to school in the fall. And here we go, we're up and running now. So
great.
Here we go. I think the question you initially told me was, what was your training with the militia like, and how much to prepare you for later deployments?
Yeah.
Okay, good stuff. So what I have here is that training has always sort of been my focus for the Army Reserves, and it stood me in good stead for future deployments. The individual training system that we offer our soldiers does focus on developing the capabilities of the soldiers very well, and it's based on some very good strong and platoon company commanders that we had within the Canadian Scottish Regiment. There was a bit of an affiliation in that one of the regular force infantry battalions used to be located in Victoria. It has since moved back out to Edmonton. But certainly there was a lot of people that served in that time in Victoria. And as they have retired from the regular force, they've gone back to the Canadian Scottish Regiment to keep serving with the reserves. With respect to the quality of training, certainly at the soldier level, I didn't find there was a serious delta or gap in any of the training that we received upon arrival for our workup training or for preparation for any of our deployments. I would say that the main difference would actually be a more aggressive training tempo that we can find in the Army Reserves. But of course, we only rarely train beyond the company level. When I say aggressive training tempo, I simply mean that when you train for just a limited amount of time, i.e. maybe a weekend or a 10-day stint in the summer. As soon as you hit the ground, you've got to hit the ground running and get as much training as you can, because we don't train as often. With regular force battalions, we might deploy to the field for as long as 2 months at a time, but of course, it's a little bit slower to ramp up. That being said, obviously the depth and the quality of training you get when you go away for a 1 or 2 month deployment is outstanding.
No, continue.
No, that's good. That's good. That pretty much wraps it up. So all that to say that the training definitely prepared us for operational deployments, but once you got to the regular force battalion, there was further work to be done so that you could take your training beyond that, you know, individual soldier or section level, to start to integrate with larger teams like combat teams or even battle groups. Now you're looking at, your artillery and your tanks and sort of that combined arms approach. And that's something that we really can't recreate within the Army Reserves, because we don't have that many resources or as many resources.
Do you think that is something that's changed over recent years, the supply of resources?
That's a good question. I think that we're challenged now as an Army Reserve specifically with resources, but I don't think that in a part-time training establishment you're ever going to be able to operate and train at that high level, just because of the expertise and coordination that takes place to run it. So I think we're better off falling in on training exercises that are being planned and executed and run by the regular force to give our guys that experience, which isn't to say that we shouldn't also try and get our planners in on that so that they can experience all the coordination and all the planning that would take to pull off an event like that. But it's just the reality of the reserves is that, you know, to plan and run an interagency 1 month long deployment exercise would be beyond our scope and capabilities for the most part right now without severe resource allocation.
Right. And talking about your militia service, what was the process of your promotion from a non-commissioned reservist to becoming an officer?
Mm-hmm. Good question there. The process itself was largely administrative, and it was based on a series of interviews that I had at the unit. It started off just based on the training I had done. They said, okay, this person shows some suitability to be an officer. And so I initially had a unit panel of senior officers. I passed that, and then I went on to the personnel selection officer, whose job is to ensure that people are suitable. And then I did a final panel at the brigade headquarters. By that time, I was a junior sergeant. I had two operational deployments overseas and had been accepted into Railroads for a master's degree program. Unfortunately, the unit, we had just lost a couple of key platoon commanders that were outstanding. They'd gone to the regular force, and the unit was looking to see who they could promote from within.
Great. What are your duties as a major in a reserve regiment?
It can really vary depending what your role is. The two roles I had as a major in the Canadian Scottish Regiment was as the company commander for A Company of Victoria, and then afterwards I was the unit operations officer. So as a company commander, first and foremost in the Army Reserves, it's being accountable to the commanding officer of the unit and the soldiers underneath your command. So that means you're responsible for the training and preparation of part-time soldiers for potential deployment overseas when they augment the regular force. And we do this through conducting collective field training exercises, and that allows them to confirm their skills and competence and prepares them for the next rank level. Excuse me. As A Company commander in Victoria, when we got together to train, we would quite often pool all the soldiers together. And so that would constitute about 80 soldiers and leaders. The company commander can't do it all themselves, and so you have a good headquarters to help you do all that planning and training facilitation. And I would say the key individuals for that are certainly going to be the company sergeant major, the company second in command, the quartermaster, and then your platoon commanders. The next biggest responsibility beyond planning and executing training is ensuring that the administrative end of the military is being met. And of course, in any organization, there is going to be a lot of administration. And that makes sure that soldiers are getting their evaluation signed off, making sure they're being put in for promotion based on their training courses, and once in a while undergoing disciplinary proceedings. As the unit operations officer, you're responsible to the commanding officer to organize the unit training plan and ensure that all the assigned tasks from the brigade commander are being accomplished. So this normally revolves around what we call individual battle task standards, which means we have to achieve a basic level of shooting, first aid, navigation, and field craft. And then we confirm that through, you know, making more interesting field training exercises. This also includes ensuring that all of our guys are fit and that we conduct our fitness tests. Part of the operations cell is reinforced by a regular force infantry warrant officer, and he makes sure that all the day-to-day demands are met and that all the exercises are properly resourced. And without that full-time capability, the job of the operations cell could not get done.
Great, thank you. From your experiences, how has the Canadian militia changed during your service?
That, again, is a great question. And I think in some ways, the Army Reserves has gotten much better. And in other ways, it's regressed. And when I say that, I'm saying it from an institutional perspective. So I also want to couch my response by saying this is based only on my opinion and based on my personal experiences. I think for the better. With the operational focus that we've had over the past 20 years in the Army Reserves, I feel like the leadership has improved its professionalism and its depth. We're now seeing unit commanding officers, senior officers, and senior non-commissioned officers with relevant and operational experience, and in some cases, even combat experience. This is going to ensure the longevity of our units by keeping them, you know, relevant. It ensures that the training is realistic. It ensures everything we do is geared towards making sure the soldiers are well prepared to, again, deploy overseas should the government need us to go overseas, and augmenting the regular force, of course. And I think, although there's still a ways to go, I think that for the most part, that's probably the best improvement we've had over the past 20 years. When it comes to the things that maybe aren't doing so well, I think it has to do with kit and equipment, and it's really starting to show its age. A lot of the personal issue kit that we get is quite adequate, but when we start talking about communications gear, vehicles, DANO, which is a term for things such as night vision and optics, and some of our weapon systems are getting quite old. I would argue that the condition isn't necessarily any better for the regular force, but I think it's indicative of a culture of, I won't say neglect by the government, but certainly with Afghanistan having closed off, I think that the emphasis is less on ensuring that we're well equipped. We've always made do with what we have, but certainly during the surge in Afghanistan, the Army reaped the benefits of rapid procurement processes. But again, that was some time ago.
Right. What changes in defense policy do you think have impacted the militia?
This is a great question, one that I think we're seeing play out in the news all the time. And I would say that, honestly, a lack of maturity as a nation with respect to defense matters by the current and past federal governments. It's led to a fairly dire situation and in many ways a bit of a hollow military. So as an example, we'll just talk a little bit about the agreed upon spending percentages that NATO member nations have said that they would adhere to. It should be targeted at 2% of annual GDP, but currently Canada spends less than 1%. So when we couple that with some of our rather archaic procurement processes, it's led to a situation where the equipment and resources we need to train and deploy isn't in the shape that it should be, or it simply isn't there. What we do have in some cases is extremely old, out of date, or broken. So we certainly pay lip service to being able to defend our sovereignty, but in many ways, I think we've become quite reliant and quite comfortable with the U.S. to provide some of our protection. I would say the best time for resourcing and training that we saw, at least from an Army perspective, was in the height of the war in Afghanistan. The Canadian Scottish Regiment sent over 50 soldiers to Central Asia on various missions, and we had all sorts of excellent training and equipment that was made available, from developing new capabilities such as psychological operations. We had new tanks with the Leopard 2s. We had new labs. We got the Mercedes G-Wagon and persistent surveillance systems. But again, that was 8 to 10 years ago. I put here too that I think on a positive note that the restructuring of the military's leadership, development and moral ethics training has also come a long way. So after the Somalia inquiry in the 90s, one of the findings was that the military needed to work on this. I've always found that at every single rank level, we're always taught how to conduct ourselves and what's expected of us by Canadians, and certainly what's expected of us overseas. And it does drive home now how accountable we are to our soldiers and our military leaders, but most importantly, how we're accountable to Canadian citizens. And I know it might seem silly, but, you know, I don't think every military in the world has always achieved this. I've been around the block a couple of times, and you can definitely see varying levels of professionalism in different militaries. But I think based on my experience that this has resulted in an extremely effective, very intelligent, and very talented non-commissioned officer corps.
Great. Great. So moving on to talk about your service abroad. Sure. I know you've already been interviewed about Bosnia and Herzegovina, yep. your deployment there. Sure. But I just had a few questions before we move on. How well do you think your reserve training prepared you for your deployment to Bosnia and Herzegovina?
It actually prepared me very well, and it's a bit of a comedy of errors there. So when I initially was told that I'd be going overseas, I withdrew from my second year, or maybe it was my third year at U of Vic, and I was all excited because I'd just come off my leadership training course in Wainwright. But when I got to the battalion, there was a mix-up on the paperwork, and so they said, well, you know, you're here, we're going to keep you, but we don't know where you're going. And I ended up doing several months in the battalion quartermaster store section, which was not the place I wanted to go as a young infantry corporal. And so I drug my feet a bit in there, and I missed out on quite a bit of the training that the rifle platoons were getting. However, I ended up driving the company commander, or the admin company commander, in Edmonton in the middle of winter, and he said quite simply, why is a fellow from Victoria, who's probably never driven in snow, driving me through Edmonton? And the quartermaster said, you know, Corporal Soli has a leadership course, he's an infantry soldier, and he's only here because of a mix-up. And then 3 days later, I reported to the parachute company, which was Alpha Company at the time, and 3PP CLI. So when that happened, I actually didn't have a lot of time to do any workup training with them, and I deployed quite shortly thereafter. So yeah, I was, all the training I had been gotten through the reserves and my leadership training in the summer. And of course, I did the bare minimum of what everybody else would have had in battalion, but I didn't have a chance to do any platoon level stuff with those guys.
Great. Were the objectives of your deployment there clear?
Absolutely, I think so. Certainly through all levels of training, they made it pretty clear what we were going over there as a peacekeeping force and sort of what our roles and responsibilities were and what the rules of engagement would be like that we were operating under. But essentially, at the end of the day, it was to go in there, and our particular area was very close to the inter-ethnic boundary line, which separated the Bosnians that were more affiliated with Serbia from the Bosnians that were more affiliated with the Croatians, and essentially we were there monitoring. We would go down to military cantonment sites and just inspect to make sure that weapons and ammunition was still locked up and being monitored. And we generally go out, patrol, engage with the people, and trying to help, I won't say the repopulation, but certainly the resettlement of people that had been displaced during all of the fighting. So yeah, we were quite clear what we were there to do, and every day was a little bit different.
Great. Great. So moving on to talk about your deployment to Afghanistan.
Yep.
How well did your reserve training prepare you for that deployment?
Another good question. Certainly good. At this point, I was a captain, so I'd had quite a bit of reserve training, quite a bit of operational experience. And again, that establishes that baseline that you operate from. So when you show up, there was always going to be additional workup training that you need. And it just is skill refresher, or maybe it's even learning new things. So it certainly was a good foundation to work from, and I feel that it did set me up for success, certainly.
Great. Did you receive any specific pre-deployment training for Afghanistan?
Yeah, absolutely we did. Let's see if I have any notes here on this one. I don't know if I did. Yeah, I certainly did. My role was going to be a team leader for a tactical psychological warfare section, and so I had to go away to Kingston to do all of that training. So I learned all the aspects of psychological operations, and I guess I would kind of liken it to marketing and influence operations in an austere, probably riskier environment. And I did all of that out in Kingston. And then we returned back to the battle group, which is who we did all of our workup training with. We went out to Wainwright for 2 months. And the first month was really focused on all of the combat skills. So we went and we supported, rather, because we were supporting agency, from section to platoon, right up to combat team. We finished with a live fire battle group attack, which was fantastic with all the players out there. And then we re-rolled for the second month into a confirmation exercise, which is run out of the Canadian Maneuver Training Center, CMTC. And that was done more with actors, and it tried to recreate scenarios that we might run into overseas to allow us a chance to kind of rehearse all that stuff. So, yeah, we were set up well for it, but definitely we had to go undergo workup training, as most of the time you do.
Right. And what were your experiences once you were over there working with local Afghan tribal leaders?
Again, that's a bit of a loaded question and an interesting one. And I think the best way I could sum it up would be that Certainly the area I was operating in 2008 was called Zari District, and it was very much a place in turmoil. And unfortunately, the people that bore the brunt of that were the local Afghans. So they would deal with us, and then as soon as we would leave, they would be dealing with the Taliban, just with respect to they were there, they were trying to eke out a living, and we were the two people that were interfering with that. So it was good and it was positive. I learned a lot, but you could certainly see that it was very hard on the local Afghans.
Right. And on that note, what was your training like with the Afghanistan National Police and Army?
A little bit different between 2008 and 2010, but it was really good in 2008. So the police force was relatively new at that point, and so we were quite often on patrol with what amounted to largely was untrained police that were doing paramilitary type duties. So I found them to be quite brave, and they certainly they understood what they were getting themselves into. So they had a good appreciation of their risks. And I have nothing but respect for the Army and the police. There certainly was the share of, corruption, and certainly their share of bad eggs, so to speak. But certainly the people that I dealt with were all very positive, and they were all very, very good warriors, just in their mindset and how they conduct themselves.
Thank you. Great. Moving on, what was daily life like at the Afghanistan Army Command and Staff College in Kabul?
Okay, so that'll fast forward us from Kandahar in 2008 up to 2010. A bit of a role change there. So I was brought in 2010 to work. I would say the experiences were basically polar opposite from Kandahar. So in 2008, like I said, I was leading a psychological operations team in support of the Afghan Army and police, but working mainly with those embedded Canadian mentor teams in Zari District. We spent almost our entire time in the field or outside the wire, with the exception of coming back to Kandahar about once a month to do maintenance on our vehicle and, get our mail. But it was definitely a highlight for me. But in Kabul in 2010, I was brought into being embedded in a Canadian training team working at the Afghan Army Command and Staff College. So we worked in partnership with the Germans and the Turkish who were on our team, and we worked nominally for the French. Our team was largely supporting a course that was full of senior colonels focused on the operational planning process. And then a few of us were seconded off to work on a captain's course that was designed for future company commanders and largely modeled after the Canadian Armed Forces Dismounted Infantry Commander's Course. So we still taught planning, but it was reduced in scope to the level of what we would call battle procedure, or what the Americans call troop leading procedure. If I had to sum it up, I would say it was a pretty civilized deployment for sure. We lived on a British camp called Camp Souter near the Kabul airport. We drive to and from the college every day in up-armored Land Cruisers. And I think a highlight for me was probably getting a chance to interact with the local Afghans and start picking up the language. I was making some pretty good inroads learning Persian or Farsi. And unlike in Kandahar, where everybody spoke Pashtun, up in Kabul, quite a few people spoke Dari, which is basically a dialect of Persian. So after 10 and a half months, I was able to get around and was just starting to become functional with my language skills. And since I was the only infantry officer there, I took on the extra task of doing all the firearms training, developing all the operating procedures for our convoys, and doing all the threat assessments from the intelligence cell. So I think both experiences were outstanding, but completely different. The level of risk in Kabul was much less than it was in Kandahar in 2008. And although there were still incidents happening in the city, they were pretty isolated.
Right. And moving backwards again for 2008, what were your experiences like during the wake of the Sariposa prison break in 2008?
That was a pretty interesting time. They have a cyclical cycle they call like the fighting season in Afghanistan. And so we arrived, it was late February. And so I would liken Zari District, we were to almost a bit of a campground initially. We could go where we wanted, when we wanted. We were largely unopposed. There was some low-level engagements, but all in all, the Canadian forces and the Afghans, because it was definitely an Afghan area, we could pretty much operate unimpeded. But as we got a bit closer to the summertime, things started to heat up. And I think a big signature event for that was a Sariposa prison attack, where they busted out hundreds of combatants. And we saw that in Zari because, of course, they started to filter out through our area back towards the border regions. So I think the result was definitely the fighting picked up for sure, and we were no longer able to go about where and when we wanted. We had to do a little bit more fighting for sure.
Right. And in your deployment in Kandahar, what was it like working with other foreign representatives?
It was interesting. It was pretty good. Because we were an interesting area in that we worked largely with the Afghan army, we did see some representation from the RCMP. We saw some representation from DFAT, and we had some of their people come out and talk to us. But then there was this one fellow who is now actually in the Army Reserve. He had been in the Army Reserve before, as well as the French Foreign Legion, and he was over there as a RCMP officer. So a bit of a juxtaposition in that there was one RCMP member that we dealt with that came as far forward as our camp, and he wasn't allowed to go any farther than that. He wasn't allowed to go with us on operations or patrols. But then I would run into this other guy in the strangest of places, and he had fully embedded himself with the Afghan National Police, and he took his job extremely seriously. And we saw him all over the place doing all sorts of stuff. So I thought it was good. And what you find is that even though agencies themselves may not coordinate very well at high levels, you find that on the ground, everybody's there trying to get their own job done, but they're all very positive and always trying to support each other. So I always found it to be good.
Great. Were the rules of engagement clear for this deployment?
Absolutely. I put a few notes on that here. I'll just scroll up too. I put here that they were certainly a lot different than previous tours to Bosnia. And although in our training system, the accountability is the same in that all commanders have to make sure that everybody understands the rules of engagements, we had no illusions to that. We knew that there was going to be an elevated level of risk and a high potential for combat operations once we're deployed. So with respect to rules of engagement, they were very clear, but based on Bosnia, they were a little bit different in that based on the operation, the commander could be delegated different rules of engagement based on the level of threat, which could authorize preparatory fires from artillery or aircraft rather than only firing in self-defense, which we had in Bosnia.
And you touched on this earlier, but what do you think, how do you think your military experience differed from your experiences in Kandahar and Kabul?
Okay, yeah. Like I said, I think they were polar opposite, essentially. I mean, when I arrived in 2008, and this was definitely a highlight for me, as soon as I got on the ground, I was in advance of my team. I was sent out with the Brigade Reserve Battalion to the Maywan District to conduct a week-long operation. The operation was with the Gurkhas, which I was pretty excited to be out with. And essentially, we rolled around Maywan, and I had a big pocket full of money. And as they talked to people, we would try to buy information, or as they did operations, we would pay for damaged goods, such as doors and windows. And we'd go from there. So it was pretty interesting. And the rest of the time, we spent mainly in Zara District supporting the, it's called the Omelet. That was the operational mentoring and liaison teams. And so I found that what we would do in terms of sort of a weekly schedule is that we would spend about 3 or 4 days operating out of the forward operating base Wilson and doing larger patrolling with the Afghan army and their Canadian mentors. And then we'd spend 3 or 4 days, we'd pump out to a combat outpost or a police substation where we had embedded Canadians with the Afghan National Police. And then we'd do some more focused patrolling in and around those little outposts. And that was our chance to really get out and talk to locals, try and spread our messaging and sort of get a feel what the impact was of, you know, the NATO operations and all the stuff that we were doing there. In 2011, in 2010, up in Kabul, it, of course, was much more of a training environment. So quite civilized. Like I said, we lived in a British camp. We drive to work every day. We were mentoring our Afghan staff to basically deliver and prepare the course themselves. And then once that was done, and we were essentially told by our colonel, work yourselves out of a job, make sure that they're, you know, capable to do their own lesson planning, to deliver the training, to evaluate the training, and go from there, then we could focus on some other things. So yeah, very different, but both very good.
Great. What does Canada's role of peacekeeping mean to you?
Personally, I don't, nor have I ever felt that it's a very appropriate term. I know that the UN does set a definition of what a peacekeeping mission or what a peacekeeping force should look like and agreed upon conditions in which it operates is kind of always predicated on the threat and application of violence. So the legal characteristic that defines peacekeeping is distinct from enforcement operations or combat operations is consent and limitation on the use of that force. But I think, in essence, a peacekeeping force requires the consent of the opposing actors to monitor an agreement. So that's more of a legal definition. But for me, that's kind of the unsavory part. I kind of feel like that statement fails to be messaged at a national level, and that an effective peacekeeping force needs to be capably trained and equipped for warfighting. And there's no doubt there's been a lot of great work done by Canadians over the years on a variety of peacekeeping missions. But the single most effective element that underpins the credibility of a peacekeeping force is the threat of violence if ceasefires aren't respected. And that's the part I feel that doesn't get messaged well.
Great. All right. And what do you think you've gained from your service in the military?
It's been outstanding. I mean, I've had through the exposure initially with the cadet program, training in the Army Reserves, operational deployments with the regular force, and the outstanding opportunity to apply leadership training. I've had some great travel, and I've conducted some volunteer service. I've been extremely fortunate to be the beneficiary of some pretty unique experiences. But, you know, if I had to summarize it, I would say it certainly taught me respect for myself and respect for the people I work with. It's definitely imbued a level of discipline just in how I conduct myself and, you know, my work ethic and whatnot. And it's also imparted, you know, a strong desire to succeed in making sure that you're successful in whatever it is that you tackle.
Great. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you would like to include?
I would just, you know what, I would highly encourage anybody that's interested to certainly consider the Army Reserves, especially, you know, in tandem with going to university, because it will provide a unique set of experiences. The leadership development, the ability to travel, deploy overseas, and it might be something that you don't like, and then you would then quit. But for some, it might be a good enabler to a lifelong career.
Great. Thank you. That's the end of my questions.
Okay.
Great. So thank you so much again for participating with me today. And did you get the interview release form I emailed to you?
I did, yes. I will fill it out and send it back to you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. All right. Is there anything you wanted to add before we end?
No, that's great. Good luck with your research, and we'll talk soon.
Great. Thank you so much, Major.
Bye.
Goodbye.